This is a Q&A session, so to close, we're just allowing anybody who has questions about the content that you've heard prior to share your questions. Please direct message Michael with your questions and do so as soon as possible. We will have Satchinandana Swami share some opening inspiration to set the tone, and then we will proceed into the Q&A structure for the rest of the time together. As always, we'll get to have an extra half an hour with Satchinandana Swami afterwards for more questions, so please do stay with us if you can. And the culture that we co-create together here is one of full-hearted participation, where we're giving our undivided attention. We really want to be present with our hearts to receive these gifts from Satchinandana Swami, and respect for the sanctity of this space, for one another, and for the teachings that are given to us, as well as determination that we have an opportunity here. This is really a golden opportunity to gain tremendous wisdom, divine wisdom, and to assimilate it into our lives. But that is up to us if we're going to do that part of the assimilation. So we ask for your full-hearted participation, respect, and determination. And if you can have your video on for the entirety of this session, it goes a long way. It's very helpful for you and for all of us as a community. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Satchinandana Swami. Thank you so much.
I thank all of you very much for showing up again, and must express my great, let me say, I feel always a sense of honor that I can share this knowledge, and also a sense of awe, because I have seen that the knowledge which I am privileged to share affects great, great transformations in the hearts of many. I'm not the origin of this knowledge. I'm just, if you so want, a peon, someone who carries a letter that was written not by him, but by someone else. And these messages have a lot of power, and I'm therefore at awe to see what they affect. There's a quote with which I would like to open this question and answer session to get us all into the mood. It says, "The words of the wise are a living stream, carrying life to the desert places of the soul." See, as souls, we are complete. We are part of the Supreme, and we share in His qualities, almost like little gold nuggets are complete. They may be covered with layers of earth, but the nuggets itself, although we cannot see their golden shine, when they are covered, are complete in themselves. So in the same way, we as souls are complete. There is nothing to add, and the world can not subtract anything from us, even though we may go through crises and through our ups and downs. Our essential self is eternal, full of unlimited bliss that is not dependent on the coming and going of happiness and distress, and we are full of inner knowledge. We get lost in desert places because our awareness, our mind, is focused in desert places. Whether it is the social media where we sometimes surfing for inappropriate amounts of time, whether it is in a job and a career that is actually not our own desire or willing, but that came to us, and because there was nothing else, we took it. There are many desert places, malfunctioning or not functioning relationships. You know better than me where are the desert places. And because we put our attention there, we invest in them, we are heaping sand on our soul, and it's therefore not a functioning, it's not aware, it's not active, it is in silent mode, so to say. And therefore, spiritual knowledge is so absolutely important to waken us up. A seed, a powerful seed, can be for a long time in the covered by desert sand, but if it is becoming irrigated, it is awakening. That's perhaps the gist of what I wanted to say, that material life works not because it focuses the attention on the desert places, desert areas that have nothing to do with our unlimitedly free and happy existence. So the words of the wise are like streams of living water that comes to the desert places in which our soul got stuck, and then awakens them, awakens us to true knowledge and to reminding us of our opportunities and possibilities. I want to see if you have now questions on what you have heard, questions that revolve in some way or another around your identity, the true identity, the true north of your life. And this, then I will try to answer and be a faithful postal peon who brings the letters from the wise people, from the tradition of the wise people, for you to open and benefit from. Good. Would we like to start? I believe as our gracious host, who has such a happy smile today, like always, has indicated there, please send your question or make contact with Michael, and then we can do this function.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Satchinandana Swami. So now we're opening it up for your questions. We will begin with Lisa Duda.
Hello there. Hi, Satchinandana Swami. It's so wonderful to be with you. And thank you so much for your inspiration, your wisdom, and your guidance over this session. So much appreciate it. So in the first session, it was mentioned that the false ego feeds on our material consciousness, and it can take on many disguises and many costumes. So in reflecting on that, I was wondering if there is a litmus test for discerning when one is acting from a place of the false ego versus the authentic self, when it is not so clear or straightforward, particularly in real time or in the moment. So again, on reflecting upon this, there are times when it's quite clear that I'm acting from my false ego. But I fear there are probably more times than not when I'm unaware of the false ego's disguises, and I'm under the misconception or the misunderstanding or belief that I'm acting from a place of authenticity when maybe I'm not. And I'm starting to inquire about this more and more, and discerning can be somewhat difficult and confusing at times, particularly in real time. So any guidance would be much appreciated.
I thank you so much, Lisa, and your question is very clear and extremely relevant. So you need to learn how discern the voices. What's the voice of the ego and what is the voice of the self? How do the two sound? And then once you know, oh, this is the voice of the ego or this is the voice of the self, you will move ahead quite nicely. See, we are spirit souls in the material world, and we have all an endowment of the living spirit in us. We are part of God, so there must be something godly in us, something divine. We call it the living spirit. You could call it the living spirit, and so on. And the living spirit has these has this awareness of I need to be dependent on higher the higher connection. I need to have the higher connection. I can't do this on my own, whereas the ego says I will do it on my own, or the ego will also say I can't do it on my own. But the difference between the spirit is in the spiritual life, you will feel I can't do it on the own, therefore I must turn to the Supreme, and then my spiritual powers will awaken. Then the little spark which is now overwhelmed will get strength and become fanned and become full of the flaming potency. The ego will say, I can't do this on my own, and therefore I'm hopeless. I'm finished. So also this false humility could be, this humility, I can't do it on my own, could be an ego thing. This true self, however, will, even in situations when one is overwhelmed, refer to a higher power, connect with the higher power, and experience the strength of the higher power. I remember such a situation in my life, Lisa. I had done this trek to Muktinath. It's a place very high in the Himalayas where there are 49 sources of water or spring, and where I saw an amazing thing, a flame of fire burning in a spring. The natural laws were not working there. On the way, however, I made a terrible mistake. I started my journey in the afternoon, and that's a no-go in this area of the Himalayas, because they're very strong afternoon storms. The temperature drops and there is snow, so I went. I saw the storms were coming, I felt the storms were coming, but I needed to continue to climb that steep track. Then the storms became so terrible that I was almost blown off the track into the deep, deep abyss. And then I took shelter behind some rocks, the snow came, and the snow was so inescapable that the storm just blew it over me, although I was trying to find a rock where I could go under. Not possible. And I knew I would either die by continuing to walk without this, walk and be exposed to the full storm, or I would freeze to death here under the snow, icy snow. It was really unpleasant and dangerous. So I gave up. Mr. Swami, I said to myself, again, you made a very foolish mistake. You should have known, you knew better, but you chose to ignore your better knowledge. Now you're lost. And in this area, you always hear about tourists who are found either frozen to death or they have crashed into the abyss. And I was right at that spot where the greatest amount of accident happened. So I started to weep and cry. And I said, now I'm gone, finished. But then I thought, let me listen, is there another voice in me? And I heard a tiny little voice that said, don't you know after all these years that you should be surrendered, that you're not independently powerful? And don't you know after all these years that even in the versus crisis, that one personality who was with you before your birth and who will be with you after your death, he is there and he is the lord of all the material energies. It's all working under his control. Now give up your false ego of doing it, being able to do, and give up the false ego of thinking I'm not able to do. But understand, there is a higher connection. Yeah, aim for the higher connection. And I heard that whisper of the voice, and then I knew it was my true self. So Lisa, to make things uncomplicated, when you hear the voice which urges you to surrender, to become dependent, a voice that tells you to give up your own, to let go of your own plans and let God do, when you hear that voice which brings you to awareness of the spiritual connection between the tiny soul, the insignificant soul, and the supreme being, then you know it's the voice of the soul. It always urges you in that spiritual direction, the voice of the soul. And the voice of the ego doesn't know of this realm. It does not. Or if it knows, then it will not urge you to surrender and trust into that. That's a very, very simple way to know. I could give an answer on a lower level where I say the voice of the ego is always selfish and the voice of the soul is selfless. And talk about qualities of the soul like compassion and so on. But you find that also in material life. You find also compassionate people who are in the ego. the main characteristic of the spiritual voice is that it always refers you to the Supreme, that it always deconstructs the little story the ego makes and urges you on, encourages you, Lisa, and even gives you the strength, Lisa, to really connect with the Supreme. In the workshop which we will do in New York, I will talk about a very quick and fast way to connect with the Supreme and hear more of the inner voice. But I need to teach that. So if you have time and if you are from New York or you are in possession of an airplane, please come.
I'll be there. I'm coming.
Good.
So I'm looking forward to it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lisa. George, would you kindly ask your question?
Hi, everybody, and thank you for all your wisdom, Sachinanda Swami, and opportunity to ask a question. Last week you mentioned that if something gets repeated often enough by enough people, it becomes culture, and then if it gets repeated through generations, it becomes a tradition. And that can be either lies or the truth that can be perpetuated. So the question that I have is, how do we identify these false traditions or these lies that get passed through the generations? And also, which of those traditions carry the truth, and how do we identify those? I suspect that the Bhagavad Gita would be one of those truthful traditions that have been passed down through the generations. But how do you identify that as being true also?
A wonderful and very relevant question. Again, I thank you very much. Once my spiritual master, who is a Krishna Bhakta, a worshipper of Krishna, asked his students, "What is your proof? Or not, what is your proof that Krishna is God? Or how do you know that Krishna is God?" You know. And one of his students said, "You told us, and we have faith in you, and we see your example, so that must be the truth." But my spiritual master, taking on the role of a trainer, said, "I may be just an old man from India who talks some folkloristic belief. How do you know?" And I think your question is similar. How do I know that a tradition is a tradition of truth or a tradition of lies? And listen, please, very carefully to the answer. For me, it is a genius answer. I do not know what it will do to you, George. He said, "You will know only by your experience. You will know by the experience of unearthly happiness." He used the word ananda or bliss, which means unearthly happiness. Happiness you have never experienced, which does not fit in the category of the type of experience you have in this world. You will know by the experience of unearthly happiness that you feel when you serve and when you chant his divine names. So he was referring to the experience you make when you enter any type of process that brings you in contact with that reality. In my a little workshop in New York. We have two, but there is one on Sunday, yes, I remember correctly, where I will lead the participants into an experience of that type, hopefully, you know, these are very high things and they are not always under our control, but I will think I can help and lead everyone either close to an experience of what this tradition in which I live and teach has to offer, or a full experience, or at least some rays of the sun piercing through the sky. So, George, it is ultimately by the experience. And the experience supersedes your deliberations and your intellectual musings. It also it also supersedes your doubts. There is, in England, they say a very, very, it's almost a gross verbing. The taste of the pudding lies in the tasting. You know, that is what it is. George, may I ask you, out of curiosity, your language is a little bit different than the typical American language. Where are you hailing from?
I'm in Johannesburg in South Africa.
Oh, yeah. It has a different tone to it. Wow. I was also in Johannesburg in South Africa. I was a guest there. Wonderful. So, ultimately, you need to enter a practice of through which revelation can take place, or an experience can take place that is beyond the mind, and so on. And then you will see that your soul gets the nourishment that helps it to blossom and to bloom, and then you know, oh, this is not just a religious narrative of some belief system, but something that delivers a spiritual experience. That is my attempt of an answer. Very good question. Please think about it, and I think you might love to discuss this further, but at another time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, George. Kim, would you kindly ask your question?
Hello, I'm Kim. I'm so grateful for this opportunity. My question has to do with the image that you conjured up that you described to us last week about the naked lost man outside of the ashram. You told that story. It was very powerful, and it made me wonder if this is exactly what some of us are worried about, or we fear, that if we strip ourselves of our material world identities, that we end up lost, disconnected, and vulnerable. I had a moment recently when I asked myself if I could give up my own identities, those that I'm becoming more familiar with, of my ego self, and I had a very visceral reaction. I felt like my heart was in my throat. I felt like I couldn't breathe for a split second. And it really felt like I was being asked to jump into an abyss, you know, and that I would be completely untethered and in a free fall. There was no sense that I couldn't even imagine what bliss would be like. So anyway, I just wanted to share that and to hear what your thoughts are on that feeling, that fear.
Wonderful, Kim, and I can absolutely sympathize with you. In fact, when I became a monk, my grandfather, who was one of the two most prominent influences in my intellectual growth, or yes, and that inner growth before I started the life of a monk. So when before I became a monk, my grandfather said, "Do you know what will happen when you do this jump? What if there is nobody there to catch you and you land on the ground? What if there is no identity, new identity to you can jump in? What if you stay unprotected and so on?" And then he told me an experience of his young, when he was 30 or so, the house in which he lived was in flames, and there was, he was on the third or fourth story, I have forgotten. The only way into safety was to jump out of the window on a piece of cloth, like a tablecloth, a big tablecloth, which the neighbors were holding. That was the only, he couldn't go, in other words, down the staircase, and there was no possibility to find a rope and climb down a rope. He had to jump and trust the neighbors who were holding something from a tablecloth and blankets to catch his fall. Now my grandfather was a giant of a man, tall like anything. So his wife had jumped and was saved. Then he jumped, but because his weight was too heavy, the neighbors couldn't. And a part of his body, it was a shoulder, came on the floor, hit on the floor, and for the rest of his life he had a problem with his shoulder. It could not be repaired, or he didn't want to repair it. I don't know. My grandfather had a very strong mind. What if I divest myself of my roles and masks? Will there be anything there that will be strong enough so that I won't be so vulnerable? Now, Kim, you will need to listen here very carefully. Don't divest yourself of all your roles and masks which you have, even though you may know this is your ego, before you have more of an identity, sense of your identity, before you have that hear that voice which gives you confidence and direction. Because if you do that prematurely, giving up what you have now and the way, what helps you to function in this world, and you have nothing instead, you are setting yourself up for problems. I have seen that very often in spiritual communities, not just my own. I was yesterday a guest in a wonderful Sufi place here in upstate New York. It's called The Abode. The project failed in the end. And I asked, why did it fail? And they said, there was still this beautiful meditation hall, and it works now as a retreat center, but no longer as a community. They said, something went wrong. The people tried to give up their false roles, move here, but we didn't find anyone who was able to wake up in a new identity where they were fully identified and thought, this is my way of life. They were vulnerable, insecure. If broken people come to a spiritual path and think, oh God, there is now safety, It's not, unless they repair their, unless they develop their spiritual identity. This is what I have seen. And if you, I come back to an earlier statement I made, you will require a nourishing spiritual practice that helps you to develop your new identity. It's almost like a tree which is locked inside the seed will require nourishing water so that it can come out of the tree, grow and develop nourishing fruits. And then it can weather all storms and all challenges that will be there. You will be able to withstand as your spiritual growth takes place the problems. The problems of material life will be there. Day and night will remain. happiness and distress will remain. Because this is the world of these dualities. But because your tree of life, your spiritual life, your tree of spiritual life has grown, you will be able to withstand these storms and little crises. Again, I mean, you all have such wonderful question. Why do I say wonderful? It's wonderful because it's so relevant to what a person who is thinking about spiritual growth and who's thinking about divesting themselves of the many prisons in which we are stuck, so to say, has to think about. Thank you, Kim.
Thank you, Kim. So we will go to Mark. Would you kindly ask your question, Mark?
Your question, Mark. That has a double meaning.
I certainly hope that you can hear me.
Yes.
I apologize. It's like 1:40 in the morning here in Japan. I've been thinking about this question for a while, Mr. Swami, and it has to do about the true self. And I would like to know about your experience when you discovered your true self and what it felt like and just your overall experience with that. I don't know how to explain that.
Yes, no, Mark. It is very, your question, Mark, is very good. You know, when you join the two words, your name and the question, then something, a beautiful word comes out. I have one experience through pain and one experience through spiritual practice. Let me start with the tunnel of pain. I had received a surgery, and after the surgery, there must have been unclean surgical knives. I got a terrible infection. They are called sepsis, these types of infections. And many people die in hospitals because of the sepsis which comes from unclean instruments. So the surgeon came that night to me, the night of in which I had an experience of my true self, and apologized himself, and he said he does not know where my sepsis come from. He assured me we did everything to sterilize the knives, the needles for your intravenous nourishment. I don't know. What I know is that in this night you will either die or you will live. And I also know, I'm telling you because you are a monk, I'm telling you very honestly, modern medicine cannot do anything for you. And then he cried, and then he caught himself, and he said, I'm telling you this as a Rolling Stone fan to another previous Rolling Stones fan. We had discussed to make contact. I had said I was a lover of the Rolling Stones before I became a monk. And he said, I'm also a lover of the Rolling Stones. And so we bonded very strongly. So he said, I'm telling you this as a Stones fan tells to another Stones fan, our you will live or you will die. Now pray, Mr. Monk. So I tried everything, first of all, to get my nerves down, breathing, mantra, chanting. It did not work. My nerves were not calm. They were, everything was going haywire. And you know, when you have nerves that are just under attack by a sepsis, it's very difficult to control the mind. I was not successful. I was just, it was just pure existential misery. Then I saw the tunnel of which many people speak who have near-death experiences. I raced through that tunnel and I came out into a vast light. And as I was in there, all the pain was gone, all this nervous, the nerves, that was terrible. I could not find any peace. I was really so upset. But it was not a mental upset, a conceptual upsetness. It was just the body working and overflooding me with signals of the highest crisis. That was immediately gone. There was peace, there was calm, there was vastness, and the understanding I'm at home here, I belong here, and all troubles are over. Then I did have some other spiritual experiences, but this feeling of, but this is what you are asking, how did this feel? The morning came, and I saw the nurse peeking rather nervously into the room. Then I said, why are you so nervous? You please come in. I knew the nurse, she knew me. And she just said to me, why am I so nervous? Look at you. And I looked in the bed. It was wet. I had sweated. My body had lost a lot of sweat. But also, no intravenous needle was there. You know, I needed that artificial nourishment. It's a salty electrolyte solution. And I also, in the other vein, there was a needle with painkillers. Yeah, and there was a third needle also. I was really, really needled up, if that is an English word. Then the nurse explained, when I came in to check on you, I saw you were moving and taking the needles out. And the doctor had told me, these things which we give will not be of any use for this man. He will either live or die. Let him do what he wants to do. He is a monk. let him go through this night, and so on. So I couldn't do anything for you. I was told to let you go through your experience. And now I checked again into your room. I was fearing that you would be in a, I don't know in what type of state I would find you. Maybe you would transmorph into a giraffe or something. You were so absolutely out of your mind. You were calling out. You were so happy, and it didn't make any sense that you were happy. I said, it made a lot of sense. I had a meeting with my true self. It made a lot of sense. Oh, tell me more about this. Yeah, and then I told her the experience. This was when I was in a medical crisis, so to say, and when I had this, you know, experience. It's called a near-death experience, where you leave the body. The tunnel, which many people talk about, is a channel, like a nerve channel or so. No, you go, you are inside, and your soul leaves through that pathway. And the other experiences are of a more spiritual nature. It is during my spiritual practice where I step back from the roles and identifications. And there is a verse in the Katha Upanishad which speaks about these different places into which you step when you remove yourself from your false roots. It's a very nice and thing, and I think you will understand, even though it's so early in the morning and you must be tired. The question is, who sees the world? And the answer is the I. The next question is, who sees the I? And the answer is the mind. You know, we collect sensual data through the eye, and we say to, and the mind and understands here, this is a plant, this is a wristwatch, and conjures some images and how the plant and the wristwatch, you know, connect to each other. It's 50 centimeters distance and so on. Who sees the mind? The intellect. Who then sees the intelligence? The Atman. This means the soul. Who sees the Atman? The Supreme Being. So, in spiritual practice, you notice the body is like a vehicle. You know, you notice as you step back, your mind and your intellect as not being yourself. As you can watch it, and you say, "Interesting, my mind feels angry." But I'm not angry now. Interesting, I observe this phenomena working in the mind. And then you go, and then as you step deeper, you come to the step more back, you come to the level of the soul and its relationship to the Supreme Soul. And there are very, very delightful experiences there. Thank you. And I will never forget that Mark asked a question, and our host said, "Your question, Mark." So that I thought this was a good combination of words. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mark. Jeremy, would you ask your question?
Yeah. Hey. Good to see you again, Sachinanda Swami. This is my wife, Anna. She's really enjoying.
Let me put my glasses on. Now I see you very clearly. Hello, both of you. Yes.
So my question is, I wanted to go back two sessions ago you have this beautiful construct of life and death, and each holding the seeds of the other within themselves. And then we had this beautiful exercise where we envisioned our death and we envisioned somebody speaking about us after we die. And I was really holding that image of those two, life and death, and each holding the key within themselves. And I fully comprehend and really feel like I understand deeply that in order to live a full life, we really need to contemplate or really understand death. But I'm struggling with the opposite one. Like, I can't seem to, how do I say, like, it feels easy to say, oh yeah, in order to live a great life, I really have to accept death. Okay, I can do that. That's a very ego kind of centric thing to say. But I was wondering if you could speak more about the corollary.
Yes.
I'm having trouble getting it, and I wonder if that's something I need to be looking at on my own spiritual path. Like, am I not, like, in order to have a great death, I need to live a full life? Is that it, or is there more?
This is a statement from Gandhi, who says, life and death are like two boxes that each hold the key to unlock the other one. So if you live properly, you will lead a life with full awareness. And your awareness will be so full that for you death is not the end, but just a door to another reality. You feel like this. I have a friend who was in his last phases. He had aggressive cancer, and the treatments, the doctors had told him, we can't do anything for you. This is terminal. So he went to a holy place, and many of us who knew him were shocked. He revealed that information, I think, a few months before his death, and we had not known this. So we were shocked, and we lamented for him. And he then said, all of you, I appreciate your affection for me, but I want to say, I have lived my life always with the understanding that I'm part of the eternal world, I'm eternal soul, and this body which you are lamenting for was really never alive. The soul, I made it alive. The moment I leave it, it gets dead. We say, he has gone, and he's gone. He's left us. So it's not that you should lament for me. I must lament for you, who have not lived that life. And I mean, when your friend says this, I say, wait a minute, I'm also on the spiritual path. But you think anew. Yes, I'm on the spiritual path, but have I lived my life in such a way that my spiritual awareness is so great that I do not fear death any longer? Therefore, there is also another lesson here, which death teaches you to live. In a previous session, I told the upbuilt community of my meeting with the king Divya Singh Deb of Orissa, who has every morning, at least at that time, I don't know if he does it still, a ceremony, listen to this, where his body is carried by a mourning party. Do I say it right? Mourning, people lament. And brought into the middle of his palace and put there While morning music is going on, very sad music, and so on. And I thought when I first saw this, he had not announced this, and I was a guest in his palace, and I came out and followed the morning procession where he was carried on a stretcher, and I thought he has died overnight. So when they put him down on in the middle of the palace, the ceremony was over. The musicians stopped making music. Those who had lamented and had, beaten on their chest, stopped doing this and talked just nicely. And my friend, the king, sat up on the stretcher. So what is this sick performance? And he then told me, I do this every morning because it reminds me of my physical death, and therefore I get the enthusiasm, courage, and bravery to live every day fully. I have nothing to lose. Meditation about one's own death was done in Europe. Those who are a little bit more culturally informed than me. No, I remember the name. Mors Moriandus. I'm not 100% sure here about my Latin. It means to think about one's own death. Writers had sometimes a skull on their writing table, not because they were some crazy grufties or something. No, they wanted to remind themselves that yes, death is coming. Use your time for the essential things. In this way, death helped them to live fully and properly.
Thank you again.
I thank you. Your good name is Jeremy, no?
Yes.
Yes, and Anna. Good.
So much. Thank you, Jeremy. Thank you, everyone. I think we will come to our close now. I just want to give Sachinanda Swami the chance to close the series with us for a moment.
Yes. Yes, we will come to the closing of this, and then there's an additional half an hour for those who still have time or would like to stay on. My closing message to all of you is, and it ties a little bit in with the first two questions, especially Kim's question. It is not enough to just speak about our true identity behind our masks and behind our roles by which the world may know us, adore us, despise us, whatever it is. It's not enough to just talk about this theoretically, read about it. You need to actually awaken the self. You need to put and the first step you are already doing, it's captured in this beautiful quote by a person called George MacDonald. I don't know so much about him, but I liked his words. The words of the wise are as a living stream, carrying life to the desert places of the soul. You need to have a constant exposure of these spiritual truths. Therefore, it's good if you keep on staying in a community. There is no faster way to grow in anything than look at like-minded people who are further on in the path, no? Who have walked further down the road. But the second thing is also, you will need to start with spiritual activities or spiritual practice in your life that will do the work of pouring nourishing water on the seed-like understanding which you have at the moment. It is some understanding which is there. You have perhaps read the Bhagavad Gita or other wisdom books. You have engaged in conversation. You have perhaps done meditational practices here and there a little bit, but you do need a consistent spiritual practice. Practice like a runner practices running. First he starts with 5 minutes, then he likes it. He goes for 6 minutes, 7 minutes, finally he can run across America or wherever he chooses to run. This is my closing message, and I want to speak a little bit about this nourishing practice in when I'm in New York. And I'm sure that if you are interested, even if you can't come, that there will be recordings available, and then you could join us in through the virtual world. Yes. Thank you for staying together for this amount of sessions, and it's a great honor, great joy. And I want to end here with the words Kalyanho. This is some blessings that were spoken whenever I learned something from teachers in the from whom I learned in India, who spoke this language, Sanskrit or Hindi. They would say Kalyanho, we are giving our best wishes that all this knowledge will be a fruit in you. So as it is time to say goodbye, I also say Kalyanho. I wish you all the best, that all this knowledge will be a fruits in you and help you and in your spiritual journey. Thank you once again.
Beautiful. Thank you, Satchinandana Swami. Incredibly blessed to have you. So grateful. Thank you to everyone for being with us for this 5-part series, How Material Life Doesn't Work. Recordings will be there for this series and in New York. Please do come see Satchinandana Swami, be part of our community in New York. It will be wonderful. And if you can stay on now, please do so. We'll have time for a few more questions. Thank you. So we will start with Arash. Are you able to stay?
Yes, thank you. Thank you so much for this opportunity. Dear Swami, I wanted to ask you, why do we seem to be wanting this group of people to seek more awareness or consciousness, while most of the society seems to be focused on the opposite, being numbed, distracted, anesthetized with social media, video games, alcohol, drugs, whatever. It seems costly to me to keep a high awareness most of the time, and I can definitely understand why somebody would like to let go and have a little bit of lightheartedness, maybe a glass of wine or two. But why do we, like, it seems to me that either, you know, we are the sober ones in a world full of alcoholics, or the opposite, we are the only alcoholics in a world of sober ones. I don't know.
Yeah, wonderful question as well. Let me look at your name, Arash. Wonderful name. When I was a child, I met, perhaps I told you this already, I met a person who told me a story that has remained with me throughout the life. He asked me, why are we humans so conflicted? One part in us wants to go to the glass of wine, so to say, and relax, and the other part wants to develops spiritual, wants to develop spiritually, and he was speaking to me. He was a professor, ex-professor. Why are you so conflicted? One part tells you to go to school, the other says, no, let's go and play. Why are we always in conflict, we human beings? Why are we not in just... listen and I will tell you the reason. He said, shaitan, the word of the devil, made the human being from clay, but no matter what he tried, he could not breathe in the spirit. The human did not walk. So he told one of the bats, you go and fly into God's bathing room, you should hide there, and when God comes in the morning, he will sneeze into a towel. Bring me this towel which has the breath of God. Then I'm sure I can make this human being walk. There will be the spirit of God. So the bat did so. He came into the bathroom. Yes. The old man opened the wise old man, the Lord opened the bathroom, and the first thing was Hachi. And the bat brought that towel to the devil, and the devil put it over the head of the clay person, and the clay person woke up with a start and said, hello. So the devil said, wow, this worked. You are mine. This moment, God came, perhaps accompanied by the angels, and said, no, he's mine. I gave him the breath of life. You couldn't do it. So the devil said, in New York you would say, damn it, it's correct. But I gave him the body. Without a body, what would he do in this world? And God said, you are correct. So then he thought for a while and he said, okay, you own his body, I own his spirit. So it's a story only. I know, it's a funny story that for sure didn't happen that way. But it makes nevertheless a point, Arash. We have physical and mental impulses in us that pull us in one direction, but we have also spiritual impulses, a longing. In Germany we say, im Schützengraben gibt es keinen einzigen Atheisten. That means, in the war trench there is not a single atheist. They all go, oh, please, please bring me out of here. If you bring me out of here, I will be good, you know, and so on. There is an inborn spiritual tendency in us. Even the existentialist Jean-Paul Sartre spoke about it. Yes, Sartre, you have heard the name, most probably, yes. He, in his philosophy, there is no place for God. But he still, in investigating the human nature, had to say, it seems that the human being is cursed to be a religious being. It seems, despite all my existential talk, there is no God and so on, I'm not successful to bring this idea out of the mind, because it's an inherent reality in us. Now, why most of us gravitate towards material life, and why even we feel this pull, this conflicting pull between, we means those who try on the spiritual path, we feel this conflicting pull between our material and our spiritual side. Why this is so? It is because we are spirits in the material world, or spiritual souls that are here. And when some people have a little bit more spiritual nourishment, they are a little bit more spiritually evolved, perhaps because they have made experiences in their lives that material life doesn't work, and look for alternatives, or they have near-death experiences which brought them to conclude there is more than the body and the mind, there is the self that left the body. I could see myself lying on the surgeon's table, but I returned and gave life to the body. There are many experiences that lead the human being to conclude that that there's a divine part, at least in him. Yeah, and I can only say we are blessed that this development took place. And now you need to just learn how to wisely navigate through your nature. When you do something like radical, perhaps you were, not you, but someone was a drunkard and he stops drinking from one day to the next. There are cases in which it works, but perhaps it's for some of the people more intelligent to just drink a little wine and then after some time be satisfied with grape juice and, you know, make their way up as they increase their spiritual strengths and so on. The philosophy, at least of Gaudiya Vaishnavism, the tradition in which I personally teach and which informs also some members in the upbuilt community. This tradition tells us don't put all your attention on detaching. Put your attention on doing those things that build up your attachment, your positive attachment to the world of the spirit. Do those things that increase that, and then these things which are harmful, perhaps they fall away like dandruff from the head. It's very simple to shed them, or old skin, or after a sunburn. You don't even need a sunburn in spiritual life. A painful experience is no need. Yes. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Arash. Pragya, would you please ask your question?
Hare Krishna, Maharaj. So grateful that you're always sharing so much wisdom with us. My question is about the wandering naked man again that we spoke about last time, and I was thinking about this, and my thoughts are that this man lost his mind for all practical purposes, but then from all of the studying we do of the Gita, we know he didn't lose his eternal self that is still in there. So he just lost the use of his mind, intelligence, false ego, all of these things that are in the Gita, the inferior energies of Krishna, I suppose. And the jiva that he is within the material body is still there. And then those of us who have not ostensibly lost our mind, we're also walking through this world. So bewildered with all the consequences of our actions, like caught in this karma web. So we are like, it's almost like we're parallel. And my question is the lesson here that we have a choice to restore that connection to the self, and this wandering naked man lost the ability to use these tools, the inferior energies, to connect to his eternal self. And he doesn't have a choice anymore. So as people who have not lost this connection, should we be mindful of this? And, you know, is there a way to, like, build up the muscle so that we don't get to a stage like his?
Yes, by all means, your understanding is absolutely correct. He had lost this ability, I hope only temporarily, and it was restored later, but I do not know his history. Maybe he is one of the cases now who spent their time in a health institution for such a case. Yes, we have there is a possibility, but only this use of the mind is only this use of the mind for spiritual awakening is only possible if you learn to direct your flow of awareness into the spiritual field. There is a beautiful explanation by a wonderful scholar on the Bhagavad Gita. There's in the 12th chapter of the Gita where it speaks about the mind has a riverbed, the riverbed of ordinary thoughts, that, and the mind of an ordinary person goes, ordinary sounds so judgmental, but the mind of most of us, even when you take a spiritual path, it can flow in the ordinary direction towards, I mean, the language is philosophical, sense objects. That means nice things to eat, nice things to dress, holidays, all the values that are there in our material civilization. Now, all this flow eventually ends in the desert, and it doesn't give satisfaction to permanent satisfaction to ourselves. You know it. Now, the spiritual person has the task to redirect the flow of the mind to spiritual things. And if you just image in your mind a river, if you want a river to flow in a new direction, what you will have to do, Pragya is your good name. Let me look here. Yes, Pragya. What you need to do, Pragya, is you need to create a new riverbed and then direct the flow of the water into this new direction. It happens also by nature. Rivers do sometimes change over a long period of life their flow. So we need to learn to direct our mind in a spiritual way. That's on a daily practice. Every moment we have the choice to act and think in a way that brings us closer to the spirit or further away from it. No? We can, in other words, direct the flow of our thoughts, and that is possible. Thank you. Wonderful question again.
Thank you so much, Pragya. Rob, would you please ask your question?
Hello, Satchinandana Swami. Thank you so much for your insights over these past few weeks. My question has to do with a story you told in an earlier session about one of your teachers, I believe, who reacted in a certain way to a very ostentatious action of a devotee who, I think, slapped some money, I believe, down on a table as an offering. And I believe the response of the teacher was to walk out of the room without acknowledgement, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And I was having trouble reconciling the teacher's response outside of the ego.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from my Western standpoint, that response could be interpreted as sort of like a petulant rebuke. And I was wondering if you could provide some clarification there for me.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about the adjective which you used before you used the word rebuke. What rebuke?
Sort of like a slap on the hand.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yes. The teacher has to always ask, am I acting and speaking for the benefit of the disciple, or am I reacting to the disciple? I would like to give you another, you know, training someone can sometimes mean that you need to stop him in his ways. Like when a child goes onto a heavily used street, the mother will, if she has a chance, dash forward and grab the child hard on the arm and pull him. And that she may do. If you blend out all the traffic, if you have a video recording and you somehow make a green forest background and not the traffic background, it would look quite violent. But when you have the real scene, it looks quite it looks different. There is one case that is taught in the tradition. One example. There is a spiritual teacher whose disciple cannot understand the need for spiritual practice. He has been in the ashram, in the training, since 30 years, and he remains so negligent of his spiritual practices, and so lazy. He doesn't do his the responsibilities which are his, which are necessary to run the ashram and so on. So the teacher invites him one morning to take a bath in the river. By the way, that's a normal setting in India. You take a little gamsha, it's like a towel, around your hip, and you go, and there are usually many people in the Gangas or wherever you take your bath. So as the bathing goes on, the teacher suddenly, from the back, takes the disciple and dunks him underwater. Oof. And the disciple first thought, well, I don't know what this means, but he comes to the breathless state, and he begins to fight Because he's starting to swallow water, and if this would continue, he would drown. So then finally the teacher takes him out of the water. And the disciple gasps for air, but then asks the question, why are you doing this to me? You're killing me. And the teacher says, no, I'm saving you. If you would understand, if you continue like this, you will live in, you will come to the point of death, and you will not be equipped. You will be not spiritually mature. You will not be grown spiritually. You will be shaken away from shaken and so on. I want to tell you, if you would endeavor with the same might and strength and single-minded focus on your spiritual path to save your eternal soul, you would be self-realized very quickly. So take this lesson or leave it. This is all I could do for you. So the... It's of course a very unconventional teaching form. I have never heard this. My spiritual master didn't do this, Rob. But in this case, it seemed to have been the appropriate teachings. Yes, a spiritual master has uses unconventional forms of teachings in some cases, where he feels this is the only way to bring him to awaken my disciple. And therefore it is said, Rob, before you choose a spiritual master, there should be a minimum of 1 year where you familiarize yourself with his way of teaching, so that you can then say, I'm very confident that you can lead me and you can inspire me. And there are moments in every guru-disciple relationship where the guru needs to work on the eggshell of illusion that surrounds the disciple, to help him to see a little opening and then evolve from the egg and start to move. Yeah, thank you. That was, again, a brilliant question. Thank you. Where are you, Rob? I'm seeing the background, the trees in your window, moved by the wind. Which part of America are you, if I may ask?
I'm in New Jersey in the United States.
Oh, yeah. But you are in nature. You have escaped that huge town with your beautiful. Good. I thank you very much, everyone. I'm secretly looking at my wristwatch. Not secretly, I just looked at it. I think we have spent a wonderful 1.5 hours. I was very, very happy, I must say, that there were good questions, very good questions. It was a wonderful session. And yes, let's stay in contact in one way or another, however it is possible for you. I will wish you all the best and give over to Hari Prasad.
Thank you so much, Satchinandana Swami. Such a gift to have your sharing with us, and we look forward to so much more. These last 5 weeks have been very, very special. Such a blessing for all of us. And yes, more to come in person and beyond. Thank you, everyone, for being with us. We're so grateful, and we will see you soon. All the very best.